This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehi Suhib, coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Well, Italian police have arrested 13 people who are involved allegedly in a major international people smuggling network, and they are accused of trafficking hundreds of people, not just through Italy, but across Europe.
That's Josephine McKenna reporting from Rome. Details coming up.
Also, UN agencies are reacting to the decision by the Trump administration to temporarily suspend U.S. refugee resettlement programs. And debate continues in Gambia over how to address alleged abuses under ex-president Yahya Jammeh's regime.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, the African Union has welcomed Morocco into the continental body, but the transition may not be a smooth one, as the central argument that provoked Morocco to quit the Organization of African Unity in 1984 has yet to be resolved. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Addis Ababa.
African leaders say, in the end, the decision to allow Morocco back into the African Union was a choice between unity and harmony. Unity won at this year's summit, when 39 of 54 AU members supported the move to welcome back Morocco after it quit in 1984 because the AU recognized the independence of the disputed Western Sahara territory. Morocco continues to claim Western Sahara, and Western Sahara remains an AU member. Their dispute remains unsettled. Egypt's Assistant Foreign Minister for African Affairs, Mohamed Idris.
The general conviction within the Union, and this was Egypt's position as well, that at the end we have to have the African house together. So it is important to find a way forward, not a divisive way forward, but to move forward on a common African interest, common African spirit. So like many other sister African countries, welcome the comeback of Morocco, and we look forward that this comeback be a step forward to find a smooth navigation on these problematic issues which have been lingering for quite some time.
Western Sahara's delegation disagrees and accuses Morocco of colonizing the large seaside territory. Ambassador-at-Large Sidi Omar says allowing Morocco to enter without settling the Western Sahara dispute violates the AU's strong stance against colonialism. The delegation wants a clear commitment from Morocco that it will abandon its claim to the territory.
It does not only concern Western Sahara or the Sahara Republic. It does concern Africa as a whole. If this principle of borders is not respected, Africa will be doomed to chaos and back to Asia's, where we're rife, fraught with conflict.
But delegates and diplomats told VOA on the summit sidelines, there may be something to the idea that Africa needs to stick together. A number of summit delegates publicly, and more forcefully privately, aired concerns about recent sudden changes in U.S. policies, not just on immigration, but also on foreign relations and climate change. Kenya's Cabinet Secretary for Environment, Judy Wakungu, told VOA that conversations at this AU summit about sticking to the Paris Agreement on climate change were overshadowed by the arrival of the new U.S. administration.
It affects all of us. The largest committers, of course, are the United States, China. Those are the largest committers. So we're seeing on the one hand that China is trying to reduce its carbon footprint, that China is committing to its national determined contribution, showing leadership in solar energy commitments, for example. But then on the other hand, we're then seeing pronunciations that the new U.S. administration is going to actually roll back on the commitments that have been made. As I've said, it's only January, and we hope that reason will prevail, because we're all in the same boat.
African unity was the original goal of the AU's precursor organization, and it appears that today's AU is trying to get ever closer to it. But in an ever more complicated world, Anita Pal, VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
UN agencies are reacting with dismay and alarm to the decision by the Trump administration to temporarily suspend U.S. refugee resettlement programs. The agencies report that the impact of this decision is having an unsettling impact upon the refugees. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The UN Refugee Agency reports more than 800 refugees set to make America their new home this week have been barred from traveling to the United States. The UNHCR estimates 20,000 more vulnerable refugees will be denied entry to the United States during the 120-day freeze of the U.S. Refugee Admissions Program. The suspension is part of an executive order signed by President Trump, as he said, to keep radical Islamic terrorists out of the country and to establish new extreme vetting measures of immigrants. UNHCR spokeswoman Vanina Mestrachi tells VOA a lengthy and rigorous screening process of refugees, which can take up to 2 years to complete, already is in place.
We do a first interview and screening, and then the countries, so all 30 countries that do resettlement, and it's not just the United States doing resettlement, does another part of the screening. They make the final decision as to who will be resettled in their country. And there's an entire part of the process, the screening process, that is in their hands. It's fair to say that refugees being resettled to the United States are among the most vetted people coming into that country.
International Organization for Migration spokesman Leonard Doyle says every country has a right to look to its own security and determine its own borders. But he tells VOA IOM is very concerned about the refugees who have gone through the screening process and security checks and then been left in limbo.
And after perhaps 4 years of waiting patiently to be resettled, they've sold their goods, they've given away their settlement in a refugee camp where they may have been for two decades. They've lost their livelihood, given away their job, handed back their ration card, only to be told, you know, at the last minute and rather cruelly, to go back to the refugee camp.
Doyle says IOM enormously respects the U.S. role as a beacon of hope for refugees and migrants for decades. He adds, while every country has a right to patrol its own borders, IOM believes in bridges rather than walls. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Italian authorities have broken up a human trafficking ring that spread from Italy throughout countries in Europe. A total of 34 warrants were issued to traffickers of various nationalities. Authorities say they had been investigating the case for 2 years. Hundreds of migrants were being transported out of Italy to other European countries in horrific conditions. Reporter Josephine McKenna spoke with me about the trafficking ring, as well as the EU's latest statement released today regarding those seeking asylum.
Well, Italian police have arrested 13 people who are involved allegedly in a major international people smuggling network, and they are accused of trafficking hundreds of people, not just through Italy, but across Europe. And this organization consisted of Egyptians, North Africans, Sudanese, Albanians, as well as some Italian citizens too. And the migrants came from Syria, Egypt, Eritrea, and Sudan. And when they made their way across Italy, usually by boat, to the Sicilian port of Catania, they would transfer to Milan, where the network had its major base. And after reaching Milan, the migrants were then transferred to Ventimiglia, the town which is right on the border of France and has seen a huge number of migrant arrivals in the last couple of years. There they were gathered together and hidden while they were awaiting transport into France and Austria.
How were they actually transported?
Well, the chief investigator, her name is Ilda Boccassini. She's a state prosecutor in Milan. And she told the media that up to 40 migrants had paid up to €1,000, so around $1,000. And they were packed like meat, she said, into trucks. Most of the trips abroad took place at night. So the migrants were crammed into the back of cars and into wooden crates inside vans in really dehumanizing conditions. And she described this network as a globalization of evil. And she said it was simply just a drop in the ocean, not really reflecting the full extent of international human trafficking and what is going on.
I understand Italian authorities had been working on this case for about 2 years.
Yes, the Italian authorities issued 34 arrest warrants after this two-year investigation. 18 involve people based in Italy, but it seems that there are others also in other countries. The investigations were coordinated by the anti-mafia police in Italy, which deals with organized crime and other crimes as well. So this is really quite a breakthrough for the police, but as the prosecutor herself said, it's really just a small victory in what is considered to be an enormous human trafficking industry that's involved in moving people, particularly across North Africa, through Libya, across the Mediterranean, into Italy and into other countries.
Also today, the EU court says that asylum can be denied to those migrants who have links with terrorist organizations. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
We had a significant decision today from Europe's top court, the European Court of Justice, saying that political asylum can be rejected for an applicant seeking protection if that person is found to have links to a terrorist organization. And that is a big decision. This case concerns Moroccan national Mustafa Lounani, who was jailed for 6 years for helping to make forged documents for jihadists heading to Iraq. Now, he applied for refugee status because he feared persecution if he was sent back to Morocco. But the court said if someone does not commit or support terrorist acts, asylum can still be denied for helping to recruit or organize or equip foreign fighters. And that could be significant for countries or authorities who are trying to protect various countries from what they consider to be alleged terrorists who may simply be migrants seeking political asylum, but who are found to have links with terrorist organizations.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna. She spoke with me from Rome.
Debate continues in the Gambia over how to address alleged abuses under ex-president Yahya Jammeh's regime. Katerina Hoya has the story from Banjul.
Tidambaro is back at work at his printing shop. His left eye is still swollen and he has a slight limp. 2 weeks ago, soldiers burst in and beat him with the guns before throwing him in a cell at the National Intelligence Agency. They said his crime was that he had been printing T-shirts for the opposition.
It was very terrible on that day because I was not thinking that I'll be back in home safe. Yeah, I thought they're going to kill me because they said it before. They said they're going to kill me.
Barrow says he will not pursue any legal action related to his illegal detention. He says Gambia needs to move on now that ex-president Yahya Jammeh is gone. One of President Adama Barrow's first acts after being sworn in early this month was to order the release of all people detained without a charge or conviction. Hundreds of people have flooded out of the state prison and intelligence agency headquarters. Rights group accused Jammeh of presiding over ruthless oppression during his 22 years in power, including torture, forced disappearances and other abuses. The question now is how to best heal the nation. Opposition leader Usainu Darboe, who was arrested last year and released last week, says justice can be cathartic.
Those suspicious of each other, you clear the suspicions and then, you know, we move forward as Gambians for the development of our country.
Gambian lawyer Assis Bensouda is also considering the question.
So there seems to be a very clear case for the perpetrators who appear to be state-employed actors or persons affiliated to the state, or at least had access to state facilities that carried out these actions. So there is a case, a criminal case to answer.
But he says building cases could be difficult.
Wounds heal, people run away, witnesses run away. 22 years is a long time. And there has been very, comparatively little recorded data on these things.
There has been some high-level arrests. Last week, Swiss authorities detained Gambia's former interior minister, Ousmane Sonko, as he sought asylum. Sonko is accused of torture-related crimes in Gambia as head of police and one of the longest-serving members of Jammeh's regime. Senegal also arrested Gambia's former prison boss, General Bora Colley, as he tried to escape to Guinea-Bissau. It is not clear what will happen to the two men, whether they will be sent back to Gambia. President Barrow has pledged to reform the security services and organize a Truth and Reconciliation Committee modeled on the one in South Africa post-apartheid. But he has declined to say whether the state will pursue any prosecutions. Presidential spokesman Khalifa Sala says for now the government is on a fact-finding mission, urging Gambians to report missing and detained people.
In a situation where people are also asking for development to take place, resources to be put to address concerns, would it be much better to use those resources to compensate the victim rather than just proceed, you know, in another process? I think these are the issues that he has looked at as a head of state.
VOA spoke to many Gambians who share that pragmatic approach. They want compensation, and they want their old jobs back and their property that they say was taken under Jammeh. And most importantly, they want their relatives freed and the truth about those who will never come home. Meanwhile, ex-president Yahya Jammeh is beginning his life as an exile in Equatorial Guinea. The country is not a signatory to the Rome Statute. Legal experts says Jammeh may well be beyond the reach of Gambian or international justice. Catherine Haye for VOA News in Banjul.
Coming up on 22 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Egypt has borrowed $12 billion from the International Monetary Fund to help curb its growing economic crisis. As part of the agreement, Cairo agreed to modify its economic program, including curbing fuel subsidies, increasing the cost of government services, and devaluing the country's currency. Average Egyptians complained that the reforms have led to higher food prices and other inflation. Dr. Mohamed Fanish is a former executive director for the Middle East at the IMF. He spoke with Mohamed El-Shenawi about the Egyptian government's handling of the financial problem.
Basically, the fund role is to provide financing relatively at a relatively lower cost. They have to reduce the budget deficit, raise the interest rate, do something about the subsidies, energy and other subsidies. Some structural reforms, do something about the foreign exchange market. These are the objectives. This, of course, in the short run will raise the rate of inflation, which is about 13 now or 14. To reduce public spending also will add to the inflationary pressure. But at least this is in the short run. But the answer of the fund and the Egyptian to that we will do something about the poor, the social network. Some of the money which will be saved as a result of these measures will be spent on the poor, whether in form of direct subsidies, food subsidies, or direct transfers, school lunch, medical expenses. This will be basically allocated to the poor. But no matter what, in the short run, there is a problem. And that's why most of the governments are afraid of taking these measures. It seems this time they're serious for reasons, I think. Some of the measures have been already taken place. For example, on the energy, reducing public spending, they already took place.
Judging from experience of troubled economies and countries with deep debts, what should Egypt do to get out of its economic troubles?
Historically, I can't remember any country made it just because of a fund program or bank program. But the program to be successful, there are conditions. If the program is homegrown, completely owned by the authorities, there is acceptance on the political and on the people's level. So the chances of the program will be much better. And there are other issues. I think in the case of Egypt now, it's not enough to either vote for the program or against the program. The question is, will this program lead, at least in the longer term, to a better economic management, or we will end up with higher costs for the poor and the middle class and more debt for the country in the long run? I think one of the issues now in Egypt, something has to be done about the political situation. for a program to be successful, you need support. So this is one area. There are issues which should be discussed openly. For example, the role of the government and the role of the state, what's the role of the private sector, the tax system, who will bear the burden? We have to think about that seriously. And the openness. Without reasonable, unified domestic front and security and political stability, it's very difficult to talk about attracting foreign direct investment or more money, because one of the objectives of the program is to catalyze more support from others, from the capital markets, from bilateral donors, from other international institutions. It's not enough to have the stamp of the fund to attract all these things. So the government has to do other things. And this program should be discussed openly and explained to the people, why are we doing that? And in the absence of political stability and freedoms, the rule of law and respect of the constitution, it's very difficult to convince the public that just accept this austerity program and things will be better in the future. So we have to be very open about all these issues.
That was former IMF official Dr. Mohamed Fanish. She was speaking with reporter Mohamed El-Shanawi.
A national strike has paralyzed Kenya's public health system. The doctors are demanding the government live up to a 2013 agreement to increase their salaries and address other issues like the lack of adequate medical equipment. But the strike has left tens of thousands of Kenyans without access to affordable medical care for almost 2 months. VOA's Jill Craig reports from Nairobi on one artist who is using his creativity to show the impact of the strike on ordinary people.
He starts with a basic idea, then fills the canvas as different thoughts pop into his head. In this case, using his pencil and paintbrush to depict the effects of an ongoing doctor's strike in Kenya.
Let me say I'm just creating awareness. I'm not favoring any side, but I'm just neutral. But I take my art. You know, art is a very powerful tool. I'm taking it as a tool to facilitate to the ongoing strike so that people can know their positions and then they can be able to come together faster and solve the issue.
And so Kenyan artist Joseph Mbatia, better known as Bert Ears, has started working on a new piece that depicts his interpretation of the strike. Not the first time he's worked on this theme. In 2014, Ebola hit West Africa, and many were concerned it might move east. So Bertiers imagined a doctor's strike coinciding with an Ebola outbreak in Kenya.
I had planned that to do that because I had some rumors that doctors were gonna strike. And in fact, they did it.
The strike happened. Ebola did not. And Bertiers showcased this piece at an East African art auction in 2015. One of the many politically and culturally motivated works he has created here at his studio on the outskirts of Nairobi. He says there's a reason for the many sardonic details that characterize his style.
With me, when I draw it like that, it gives more impact to people out there to see that the matter is becoming even more serious. When you go to the hospital and find that there are some dead people in the bed and the others who are coming to see their loved ones, whether they are being given drugs, it is really not too good.
And as he continues to work in his studio, Bertier says he hopes the doctors will soon go back to work as well. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yiswuhi in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis, and thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I am your host, Shaka Sali. Every Wednesday night, the Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you.
Next, on Straight Talk Africa, the 28th African Union Summit.
voting for a new leader, discussing the re-entry of Morocco, and mapping the future of the continent. That's right here on Straight Talk Africa at 1830 UTC.